Easy there, steady now. By Rydra Long. Read by S.K. Lee. So, any suggestions? Colonel Mitchell says, rusty voiced. In future, I believe it would be wise if you desisted from attempts to rescue me. Tilk replies. As he intended, Mitchell is startled into brief laughter. Then he raises his bound hands to wipe ineffectually at the water on his face and shudders again. His clothes are sodden and clinging, and he is barefoot on the muddy sand. Tilk removed his boots before fastening the zip ties around his ankles, but he does not believe that it is the cold which is making Mitchell shiver. The sample canister is heavy and cool in Tilk's hands. It's sealed tight, and the LED of the power cell glowing. It is still possible that they could complete this mission. He stows it securely, then assesses their position in the gathering dusk. Safer to make camp where they are, on the lake shore itself. The water can no longer be a danger to either of them, but fear of what it contains will keep the Unas at a distance. It is unlikely that they will be ambushed again during the night. This is a temporary thing, right? We get back, phone up the Tok'ra, the Asgard. The extraction process is now a simple procedure, Tilk agrees, offering as much calm as he can. Well, I guess this beats the trifecta. Jackson's never been snaked, has he? Mitchell closes his eyes briefly, then opens them again.
Hey, this mean I get to use all the cool Gould toys?
These primitive symbiotes have no Nakoda in their blood. Damn. The sincere disappointment on Mitchell's face reminds Tilk of Ryak as a child, deprived of a treat he believed himself to have been promised. He will not pitch the tent, he decides. It will be necessary to watch Mitchell and the tree line simultaneously to be able to move instantly. Instead, he checks the gear. Weapons, tritonin, food, tablets for purifying water, then starts gathering branches for a fire. Drenched clothes and a cold night are the least of the hazards they face, yet they are not negligible. Mitchell coughs and grimaces. Oh man, that's blood. Feels like someone took a cheese grater to my throat. That's just gross. Tilk can see his adrenaline rush dying, watching him run down like a cheap clockwork toy, wound too tight and then allowed to chatter itself into silence. Why am I still here? Not that I'm complaining, but I mean me. And not doing the whole flashing eyes world domination thing. Most probably, the symbiote was immature. It will take time to gain complete control of the body. Right, Mitchell nods. I'll let you know if I start jonesing for glitter or funky hats. Tilk thinks of Kowalski. Blood and bone and brain tissue smeared on the grid of the ramp. He turns away and looks for another branch dry enough to burn. Later, balancing an MRE on his knees, Mitchell says, if Sam and Jackson went back through the gate when I ordered, then the SGC is going to know we have an Ori situation here, at least. Tilk makes a short noise of acknowledgement. They will not risk another 304 after Tagalus. If they send backup, they will seek to avoid direct confrontation with the Ori. So, we head for the gate first thing. A question, not an order. Although with Mitchell, it has always been hard to tell the difference. Nonetheless, Tilk finds himself surprised by how easily Mitchell has ceded command and permitted himself to be restrained. Their strategic instincts are often similar, and yet it shows an eagerness to trust that he would not have expected from someone whom he has known for such a brief time. Will you look at that? Mitchell says. P3X888, second moon, is rising above the trees now, and he stares at it like a promise. When Tilk glances over, he continues grinning. You gotta admit, that's pretty cool. When I was a kid,
My dad had these old science fiction paperbacks. Some of them looked just like that. Two moons. That's how you know you're really on an alien planet. The planet of Chulak has two suns, Tilt points out. Huh. Then, sideways and canny, scooping more food into his mouth with unexpected deftness. You're saying that none of this is new to you. You don't get amazed by anything anymore. There's much in the universe I find worthy of wonder, he concedes. He remains cross-legged by the fire while Mitchell wriggles clumsily into his sleeping bag. Meditation will reduce his body's demands for sleep in the short term. When the need becomes pressing, he can sleep lightly while sitting and wake instantly. For the present, he stares out over the lake, watching the night deepen until the broken reflection of flames is the only thing differentiating water from trees from sky. Glancing over, he sees that Mitchell is curled up on his side, bound hands in front of his face, fingers interlocked, eyes shut and lips moving silently. After a moment, his eyes snap open as if he feels the pressure of Tilk's regard. He glares indignantly for a second, face reddening as if he'd been caught at a more intimate activity, then rolls over awkwardly. A while later, Tilk realizes that his gaze has been lingering on Mitchell's back instead of the water. The following day, they cover less distance than Tilk had hoped. Mitchell's jacket and boots are still damp. He insists on carrying his own pack as they hike through the woods, but his bound hands impair his balance, making him clumsy. And he talks even more than usual, as if the sound of his own voice is a comfort. Tilk lets him take point, following behind with the compass and his hat. He only partially listens to Mitchell, most of his attention absorbed in scanning the trees for sudden movements or sounds. Any rustle of leaves or snap of twigs that does not come from small animals or their own boots. As ever, the lack of response does not seem to deter Mitchell from discoursing on such topics as how much their intel sucks or possibly blows, momentarily diverting Tilk into amused contemplation of the vagaries of the English language. The merits of various flavors of ice cream. Tilk is briefly moved to interject in favor of New York Super Fudge Chunk. The possibilities for the next movie night, the makings of a fine red-eye gravy, and a variety of antidotes, most of which involve members of his extended family, explosions, or both. So anyway, I said, man, that thing's gonna blow up any second. I said... Tilk turns at the sudden silence and realizes that Mitchell has stopped, staring blankly into the trees. What was I saying? I don't. Then abruptly, tight-voiced, I think I'm losing it. Tilk catches up with him and grasps his arm firmly, feeling a faint tremor even through the mud-stiffened fabric of Mitchell's jacket. I believe you were telling me how you came to learn Mandarin. He lies smoothly. It may even be true for all he knows. Mitchell shakes his head dizzily. Sure, yeah, but he does not continue speaking. 10 minutes further down the path, he adds casually, never gonna play poker with you, man, you know that. By evening, they are still in the forest. Mitchell slumps down with his back against a tree and stretches out long legs to let Tilk tie his ankles again. Now be a good time to tell you I'm not really into bondage, he inquires. In all his years with the Tauri, Tilk has never found an appropriate response for such remarks. So he remains silent, his gaze on the wet leaves clinging to Mitchell's boots. Damn, my head's killing me, he adds more quietly. Tilk has already noted his increasing pallor. We got aspirin in the med pack? Pain medications may reduce your resistance, Tilk tells him. No respect for your CO, Mitchell mutters without real heat. Tilk checks the containment unit again before setting up camp. Able to live and breed in the water without incubators or hosts, these primitive symbiotes may end the shortage of Tritonin. Ironic that the Jaffa should depend upon the Goa'uld still, though this time they may exploit rather than be exploited by them. Man, it's creepy thinking of having one of those things inside me, Mitchell comments.
Then he glances up and adds hastily, no offense. None is taken, Tilk says, allowing a flicker of his amusement to show. Once Tilk has started the fire, with a handful of dry moss for tinder, Mitchell says, they should start putting marshmallows in the MRE packs. Can't think of a mission that wouldn't be improved by s'mores. Tilk hears the noise in the trees first and freezes, listening. Mitchell breaks off in mid-sentence, turning his head, trying to locate whatever has caught Tilk's attention. Movement on at least three sides, too purposeful for animals. As the units emerge from the trees, Tilk drops into a squat to make himself appear smaller, less threatening, P90 balanced across his thighs. He counts at least five units and presumes that more remain out of sight. Behind him, he can feel Mitchell's stillness, wire taut. Whether these units have succumbed to the Ori or not, they will not welcome intruders into their territory. Once they were the stuff of his childhood terrors, now he knows them for another people, willing to fight for their freedom from slavery. He does not wish to kill them, unless there is no alternative. The first Unus moves forward, a few low, crunching steps nearer the fire. Not the leader, he estimates, but a subordinate. He suspects that the leader is a larger male who remains slightly behind, judging by the way the others look to him for cues. If necessary, he will shoot him first. He rests his hand lightly across the gun, fingers drifting closer to the trigger. Ki-ka, Mitchell says, then repeats again, more loudly. Ka, ki-ka. The lead Unus lifts its head, listening. Tilk does not take his eyes off it. Uman-ka-naya-Unus. Mitchell stumbles over the words awkwardly but clear. Ka-naya-danel. The Unus stares at Mitchell for a long moment. Then it growls, but begins backing into the trees. The others follow its lead, one casting a curious glance back at them. Ack, Mitchell says softly, mostly to himself. Once he is sure the Unus have gone, Tilk turns to give Mitchell his own curious glance, one eyebrow raised in question. He has almost become accustomed to being surprised by him. Mitchell shrugs, bashful and pleased with himself. Jackson wrote up a crib sheet, put it in the files. Tilk inclines his head in a small bow, and Mitchell grins at him, face bright in the firelight. He does not lack confidence, and yet he thrives on Tilk's approval. If Mitchell were a younger Jaffa, Tilk would have no doubts about how to interpret his behavior. Custom and tradition would sanction relations between them. But Mitchell is Tari, and Mitchell is his commanding officer. He does not treat Tilk as an alien, yet neither does he try to pretend Tilk is human. He will not keep his distance, but Tilk does not know how far his differences go, or where his limits lie. A human with a symbiote in him, a Jaffa without one. There are no customs for this. He awakes to blackness, deep night, and for a moment does not know what woke him. There is a chill touch of moisture on his skin, dew or a light rain. The fire has burnt down to sullen coals, and Mitchell is crouching by it, coiled tight, staring into the dark. It is only when he turns that Tilk sees the white gold flare of his eyes. His zad is in his hand without conscious thought, before the light has faded. The Goa'uld raises his bound hands between them, as if in supplication, or to show him that it is still restrained. He does not try to interpret the gesture, but fires immediately, watching Mitchell convulse in the blue crackle, then slump to the ground. Once he is incapacitated, Tilk rolls his limp body onto one side, unfastens his hands, and then reties them behind his back. There are red marks on his wrist already, where the plastic restraints have cut into the pale skin, too tight for comfort. But it would be no kindness to either of them to loosen them. As it is, Goa'uld will be able to break them, sooner or later. He will not underestimate Mitchell. He has sparred with him, testing Sodan fighting techniques against those Tilk is familiar with. Mitchell is barely trained, but he veers unpredictably between clumsiness and grace. Capable of landing blows, he does not yet have the control to pull. Smaller and weaker than Tilk, of course, but with Goa'uld's strength, he might present a challenge. Tilk is certain that he could subdue him if needed. He is less certain he can do it without injuring or killing him. Mitchell groans, then suddenly thrashes, a panicked half-struggle. "Colonel Mitchell," Tilk says sharply, and feels Mitchell's muscles relax under his hands even before he twists his head around to look at Tilk. What the hell just happened? While you slept, the symbiote was able to take over for a short period. "Crap," he mumbles. Did it? It was unable to cause any harm. Zatnik Katel's shot disrupted its control, perhaps for some time. He helps him up onto his knees. Mitchell jerks, shaking the contact off. Not afraid, Tilk realizes, but breathlessly angry and humiliated, refusing to be afraid. "Colonel Mitchell, you have what Colonel Carter has called a capacity for almost delusional optimism. I would advise you to utilize it." "Yeah, I'm working on it." Mitchell's voice is shaky, half between laughter and panic, the tide of anger receding again to expose the fear underneath. He breathes deeply. "So it have a name? The Gould thing inside me?" It did not speak. "Huh. Thought they all did the 'I am your god, bow puny mortals' number." He deepens his voice, attempting to imitate that of a Goa'uld. The performance seems to buoy him up for a moment. "Elvis," he announces. "I'm calling it Elvis. That would totally work as a name for a Gould. Later Elvis, anyway." It is something Tilk has come to think of as characteristically Tauri, making mockery of what they most hate and fear. Just as O'Neill would never speak of Ball without a joke. Mitchell glances up silently then, and Tilk realizes that for once he is looking for an answer, a response, as if he has run out of words with which to hold himself together. Tilk has no bright empty chatter to offer. He is always cautious when touching humans, conscious of their many taboos, but he reaches out a hand carefully and cups Mitchell's face in his palm. Mitchell stares at him, then squeezes his eyes shut, pressing his face hard into Tilk's hand, stubble prickling against his skin. It is not the fact of Mitchell's desire that stings him, but the sudden nakedness of it. There's a bravery in this, too, he thinks, in wanting so transparently. "I'm not gonna beg." Mitchell's voice is almost inaudible. Tilk realizes that he has been still for a long moment. He shifts his weight forward onto his knees, leaning in, close enough to breathe the same air. Mitchell inhales sharply and twists his head, trying to reach Tilk's mouth, then stops abruptly, understanding. Tilk cannot be taken as a host, but there is no assurance that this backwater Goa'uld knows that. The blood of a dying symbiote could kill both of them. Instead, Mitchell sighs and lets his head drop, nose bumping Tilk's cheek. He pushes closer, turning his face from side to side, rubbing blindly against Tilk's skin, frustrated and yearning, as if he could somehow breathe him in, draw strength from him. His hair is damp with sweat under Tilk's fingers, and he has a sour smell of sleep and nightmares. Tilk holds him as carefully as he would handle fire or a freshly sharpened blade, anything dangerous and fragile, worthy of respect. He is still half expecting him to pull away when Mitchell's mouth finds his jaw, a brush of dry lips before the wet within, the pressure of tongue and teeth, an exasperated almost bite. His own mouth is on Mitchell's cheekbone then. Blood heat under tired skin, bitter taste of dirt and rain on his tongue. Mitchell saying, "Jesus," in his ear, his hand slipping down to the nape of Mitchell's neck where the hair is cropped shortest, back again to feel the buzz of it against his fingers. when he slides his hand under the edge of Mitchell's jacket, shoving it back off his shoulder, Mitchell pushes hard into his grasp, muscles moving under his t-shirt as he strains at his bonds. "Yeah," he says, mouth against Tilk's skin, then fervently, "Tilk." He finds a sensitive spot at the corner of Tilk's jaw, just under his ear, and kisses there, mouth open and hungry and wet. Tilk imagines what that mouth might feel like on his nipple, what the weight of Mitchell's cock might feel like in his hand, and his grip tightens, thumb digging into the knot of muscle between neck and shoulder, deep enough to elicit a groan. He has enough caution to drop his other hand to Mitchell's thigh, where he can pin him or block a knee strike if need be, anchoring him. Mitchell rocks into that pressure, hips lifting, and Tilk lets himself kiss the corner of his mouth. Close enough to feel Mitchell's half-swallowed wordless murmur against his own lips. Too much of a risk, but he cannot bring himself to break off completely. Not yet. Instead, he pulls back a little and lifts his hand to Mitchell's face, tracing lightly down the straight nose. When Tilk's fingers brush across his mouth, Mitchell's eyes open and he bites at the pad of his thumb, grinning. Mouths it when Tilk pushes it in, swirls his tongue around it hard, fierce and wistful, a promise of a future occasion they may not have. Tilk braces his hand on Mitchell's shoulder again before he finally pulls away, as gently as he can. Mitchell sways towards him, stretching the contact out a moment longer, before he sits back on his heels, looking rumpled and dazed. He lets his head drop, breathing hard. This is a really bad idea, isn't it? "Indeed," Tilk says as blandly as he can, and watches Mitchell's head jerk up again, a flicker of indignation on his face before he catches Tilk's eyes. He gives a short laugh and a wince. "Oh, hell, my hand's gone to sleep." Then shrugs awkwardly, trying to hitch his jacket up over his shoulders again. Tilk grasps the collar and pulls it up, careful not to let his fingers brush against the skin instead of cloth. The moment has passed. Mitchell seems more solid, somehow, as if he has assured himself that his body is still his own. "We will speak of this when we have returned to the SGC," Tilk tells him. "Yeah, sure. We'll get a couple of beers and talk about the relationship." The brash confidence sounds a little like disbelief. Tilk holds his peace. He will not dishonor what they have shared by offering words of false comfort, as if to a child. Mitchell sighs then, the tension breaking. "So, I'm thinking sleep would be a bad idea, too. Is caffeine allowed?" Tilk collects the plastic sachets of coffee from the MRE packs and sets water on the fire to boil, adding more branches and prodding the embers back into brightness. The damp wood smolders before catching light. He holds a mug to Mitchell's mouth so that he can drink, watching the lines of his throat as he swallows. When the mug is empty, Mitchell sits back again. "You got any cool Jaffa mind tricks that might help?" "I do not believe that any amount of mental discipline would suffice." "Well, cards are out." Mitchell shrugs in demonstration. "It's not going to be light for a while yet, and I, for one, would rather not sit here listening to that thing getting cozy in my cranium. Give me something. Anything." His voice is weary. Tilk looks at him for a moment, reading the sag of his shoulders and the tightness of his jaw. He knows the taste of Mitchell's skin now, the heat of his body. Like another way of sparring, he thinks. Another way to know someone. "It is most important to start by sitting with your spine straight," he begins. "Incorrect posture causes unnecessary tension in the mind." Mitchell's eyes flutter open for a moment. "My grandma would have loved you," he says, smiling, then composing himself. "Sorry, go on, I'm listening." In the morning, Mitchell refuses to eat. "If I eat, I'm gonna puke, T." Tilk forces him to drink water, then pulls him to his feet, but does not touch him any more than necessary, protective of his dignity, of his anger. This time Tilk carries both packs, and Mitchell does not protest. He is getting steadily more disoriented, blacking out for long moments. Although the Goa'uld has not yet seized control again, it is as if Tilk is watching someone drowning in slow motion. Once, when he had been at the SGC for barely a month, he had come upon O'Neill leaning against a wall, talking softly to Daniel Jackson. "Come on, Scara, Share, they're tough. They'll fight. They're not going to give up. We'll get them back. You just have to hang in there." Daniel had looked up then, his eyes going wide behind his glasses, as he saw Tilk, and they did not continue the discussion in his presence. For his part, he did not tell them that it goes harder for the strong, that a host who struggles will merely take a longer time to break. He and Mitchell walk in silence, trudging slowly uphill. The Stargate should be visible over the next ridge. They see the blue glow of the Prior's staff first, before they even reach the edge. There is nowhere else to go. Once they've retreated out of the Prior's immediate range, Tilk finds a spot on the side of a hill that presents as suitable a campsite as any. It gives an adequate view of the surroundings, with an outcropping of rock at their backs, making it potentially defensible. Mitchell drops to one knee, balancing awkwardly on the stony ground. "We got a plan B? The SGC will undoubtedly seek to render us all possible assistance. So we just sit tight and wait to be rescued." Mitchell's face is tired under the smears of dirt. When Tilk does not answer, he adds, "You don't ever get downhearted, do you, T? Not that I'm complaining, it's great, but..." Tilk thinks of despair, of dying endlessly in a computer game, things that are not in the files. He thinks of the number of days Tritonin he has left in his pack. "When I first came to Earth," he begins, "I did not know how the Goa'uld worked their magic, only that they were not gods. Since then, I have seen many things come to pass that I once thought were impossible. What I believe to be possible or probable in any situation is not relevant. The only thing that matters is to select the correct course of action." There's a long pause, broken only by the faint rustle of wind in the leaves. Then Mitchell says, "So as you know, I read Kowalski's file, too." He looks at the ground, refusing to meet Tilk's eyes. "It comes down to you or me. Choose you." Before Tilk can reply, Mitchell adds quietly, "That's an order." Tilk bows his head silently then, reaching out to rest a hand on Mitchell's shoulder. This is a warrior's right. He will not take the decision away from him. He will not tell him that he would never have made any other choice. The wind is raising suddenly, and he can hear the crash of branches, the beginning of a storm perhaps. They will need to take cover. The sky is clear. He breaks the contact abruptly. Mitchell slumps, collapsing as if the touch was the only thing holding him up, and stands, scanning the valley for something he cannot yet identify. He can see that the movement of leaves and branches centers on a point further down the valley where the trees are less dense. Not a natural wind, but something artificial. Foliage being forced aside by something invisible. A cloaked ship, he realizes. A ship is landing. A Tel-Tek, he guesses from the size of the disturbance. "Look." Mitchell does not look up. He's shaking his head, twisting, as if to throw something off. Then grates, "No." Voice metallic, resonant. Tilk zats him and watches Mitchell struggle to the surface, gasping and blinking. He pulls him to his feet and into a stumbling run down the hill, one hand clamped around Mitchell's upper arm. They have almost reached the ship when Mitchell's feet skid out from under him, his arm wrenched from Tilk's grip by the momentum of his fall. Unable to break his fall with his hands, he goes down hard, hitting the ground and rolling among the tree roots and broken stones. Tilk is already reaching for him when he sees that Mitchell's hands are free. He pulls back fast, raising a zap between them. The Goa'uld in Mitchell's body pushes smoothly to its feet and steps towards him, hands spread wide and head tilted, eyes flashing immaculate gold in the muddy face.
Shoot again,
it tells him, amused and reasonable.
And you will kill the host.
He does not hesitate, and yet he must have, for the barest fraction of a second, because his shot goes wild, skimming past Mitchell's shoulder. And then the Goa'uld is already moving, dodging not away but towards him, grappling with him, slamming his arm up and away with inhuman strength before he can grasp his rifle. He feels a blow in his gut, a teeth-jarring shock, and thinks at first that he's been punched. But when his grip loosens, the Goa'uld pulls away, holding his Beretta. It calmly aims from a few paces away and shoots him in the stomach again. His knees buckle, and the ground rushes up to meet him. The Goa'uld steps over him and walks towards the clearing. Tilk rolls onto his side, presses his hands into his belly, and watches blood seep between his fingers. On the ground, the ship is decloaking. Colonel Carter and Daniel Jackson emerge almost before it has fully shimmered into view. The Goa'uld moves towards them in Mitchell's loose lope. There is no Naquadah in his blood. Colonel Carter will not be able to sense him. Tilk flattens one palm on the ground and pushes up onto his hands and knees, clenching his teeth against the nauseating surge of pain. He drags himself towards them, one agonizing lurch forward, then another. Surely they must be able to see him now. He is too far away to see their eyes, but the Goa'uld is not, and Tilk sees him hesitate for a moment. Then he calls, human-voiced. Man, I'm glad to see you guys. Unas attacked us. Tilk's down. He needs help. Daniel is hurrying towards Tilk already. Carter slings her pack to the ground and drops on one knee beside it, putting her P90 down as he reaches for the med kit. Mitchell is between them and the ship now. Daniel is at his side, and Tilk clutches at his arm, dragging him down, pulling them both down as his own legs collapse beneath him. Daniel Jackson, he gasps, with all their strength remaining to him. He is Goa'uld. Daniel is capable of doubting everything in the universe, but he does not doubt Tilk's word. He's already lifting his P90 as he turns, aiming and firing in one smooth motion. His shot hits Mitchell in the leg, a single shot, aiming to immobilize, not to kill. The Goa'uld howls, and Carter turns in time to see its eyes flash. Mitchell staggers but does not fall. Then Daniel's second shot hits him in the shoulder and he crumples. The noise he is making as he curls up on the ground is wholly human. We have to get clear of the planet, Carter says urgently, her gun already back in her hands. Daniel hooks an arm under Tilk's armpit and starts trying to pull him to his feet, and then he must have passed out, because there is nothing but blackness after that. When he returns to consciousness, he is laid out on the floor of the ship, a pad of blood-soaked gauze pressed to his wound. Daniel Jackson is holding it in place. The engines are starting, a dull thrum through the floorboards that he can feel in his back, in his spine. Mitchell is lying near him, a hastily applied field dressing on his shoulder. He flops out his free arm, fingers brushing Tilk's shoulder awkwardly. Buy you a beer when we get back, he says in a ragged whisper. Then his expression shifts, slipping sideways like a mask, and Mitchell is gone again before Tilk can remind him that he does not imbibe alcohol. Tilk accepts the painkillers without protest. His injuries will be slow to heal, but he knows that they would have killed a human or a Jaffa who still carried a symbiote. He has learned to appreciate such ironies. Mitchell's body has no need of drugs. The Goa'uld within him, repairing the physical damage with ease. Already he sits cross-legged, handcuffs fastened to the golden wall, still as a statue. Tilk recalls sitting in the same manner, on another cargo ship, years before, absolute in his faith that he was the loyal first prime of Apophis, who remembers O'Neill's attempts to talk with him. Colonel Mitchell, he says, when we return to Earth, there is much we must discuss. Hey, Tilk, the Goa'uld says in Mitchell's soft drawl, parody perfect. I am not addressing you, he tells it. Outside the window, hyperspace rushes by in streaks of blue and violet as the little ship carries him safely home. The end.